Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die." "You will certainly not die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings.
If you weren't here last week, we are in the middle of a sermon series on the seven deadly sins, or as I mentioned last week, maybe a better terminology, the seven capital sins. And I spent quite a bit of time last week giving you some background, so if you were not here, I encourage you to, if you want to go on our website, listen to that. But just really briefly, we're doing this because we're trying to take a deeper and more honest look at ourselves. I talked about last week, often we have these ways of trying to detect sin in our lives, and often they're quite insufficient as we mature as disciples. So the image I gave you is that we're trying to kind of shoot an x-ray into us, to get deep down in there in the interior and find out what is really happening. Today we look at the deadly sin of envy, and we're going to turn then to its virtue, contentment, and we'll do what we did last week. We'll split the sermons up in two. The first one will be longer than the second. And in the middle, Christiana will lead us in a time of confession and a spiritual practice that will help us on this movement from envy to contentment. So what is envy? What does it mean to be envious? I think most of us at its most basic level would say envy is kind of like wanting something that someone else has. So there's something we want and we feel that we currently lack that thing. And at times we kind of lump together three terms: envy, jealousy, and covetousness. So covetousness, not a word, it does not roll off the tongue, boy. Not a word you probably use in your daily life. Probably familiar because it's one of the Ten Commandments. That's probably how it's most familiar. So you shall not covet your neighbor's house, wife, ox, donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So often we focus on possessions. So when we're talking about covetousness, we're often thinking about, I want that possession that belongs to that other person. Jealousy is different. You know, kind of a more technical definition in the Bible is jealousy is usually you already have that thing, but you're worried about it being taken away. So we think about jealous lovers. The person is already yours, but you're always worried about losing that person. But think about how we typically actually use the word jealous. So if you told me, this is going to speak to myself, but if you told me I went backpacking in Colorado for 2 weeks this summer, I might say something like, "Oh man, I'm jealous. That must have been incredible." I'm not into cars. If you're into cars, your neighbor might buy a brand new BMW and pull up and you say, "Oh man, I'm jealous of your car." You know, you love cars and you see this. To be honest, when we use the word jealous, we're usually talking about things that, yeah, it'd be nice to have. It'd be nice to go to Colorado. It'd be nice to have maybe a BMW. But I don't think we're not really torn up about not having it. But envy is something different. So I don't hear many people say, "I'm really envious of fill in the blank." So we might be fine revealing our jealousy of a vacation or a car, but I can almost guarantee you're much less eager to reveal what you're envious of. Now think about why that is. I think it's because we're talking about jealousy, we're talking about possessions, when we're talking about envy, we're talking about ourselves. We're getting into much more vulnerable spaces, much spaces that we usually do not want to share. Let me say that again. When we talk about envy, we're usually talking less about possessions and more about who we are as people. And this is going to be important because as we're going to talk this morning, what I want to really drill down to is probably something much deeper than you initially think about when you think about your jealousies and your envies. Because we're going to be looking at questions like, where does my self-worth? How do I experience love? What is my identity wrapped up in? So for example, you might be jealous of that BMW because you love cars, but at a deeper level, you might be envious because of the admiration or the respect that person gets from driving that car, the feeling that that person has made it and I haven't. Another thing about envy is that it is not eager to reveal itself. So how often have you heard somebody say, I know this is going to sound like bragging, but I just have to tell you, I am so proud that Susie got the lead in the high school play. I don't know, whatever you're proud. How many times have you heard someone say, like, I don't want to tell you this, but I'm just so envious that this person got into a way better college than Susie did. Like that's tapping into something a little bit different. Because the thing about envy is that it is no fun. If we're totally honest for a minute, the other deadly sins, a lot of them are kind of fun. I know that might weird you out to say that, but they feel pretty good in the moment. Maybe not long term, definitely not long term, but in the moment, pride feels good. In the moment, lust feels good. Gluttony feels good in the moment. Sloth feels good in the moment. Even anger can feel good in the moment. You get this kind of blood pulsating through your body. It feels kind of good. Envy never feels good, not even for a second. Nobody ever enjoys being envious. It is the self-punishing sin. Like, you don't need to punish envy. Somebody who's envious is doing all the punishing themselves. So if these other sins kind of feel like a warm bath that comes over you, like, this is like a kick in the stomach. This is like, as Socrates says, envy is the ulcer of the soul. And the longer you remain envious, the more envy becomes part of your life, the more it will fester inside you and become like a cancer, like a poison in you. So if you look at your bulletin, the color for envy is always green. I think that's very good. It's like a sickness. You know, think about green. It kind of reminds us of sickness. So envy tends to be about more than possessions. It tends to be things about like our self-worth and our identity. It's not fun. It's also the most social of the capital sins. So it always takes two to envy. And the reason that is because envy is, at its core, comparison. So a guy named H.L. Mencken once said, in America, contentment is making $10 more than your brother-in-law. And I think that's a great quote because it highlights a few things about envy. One is that, like I said, envy is a comparison game. Two, we don't tend to compare ourselves to people who are really far removed from our lifestyles, or people who are vastly more successful than us. We tend to compare ourselves to people who look a lot like us, but they're just a little bit more successful, just a little more talented. Which is why people are way more envious of their brothers-in-law than they are of Jeff Bezos. Are you envious of Jeff Bezos? Like, I can't even get my mind around $110 billion. I've never met anybody who's envious of Jeff Bezos. I've met lots of people who are envious of their brothers-in-law making $10,000 more a year than they. If you're a writer, I'm going to pick on our household here, okay, just for a minute. If you're a writer, J.K. Rowling does not make you envious. It's that person like that graduated the same time as you, who has one more published book and a rave review in some literary magazine. Like, that's the person that strikes at the envy. I'll pick on myself here. Sherry Malice used to love to tell me how great a preacher Alistair Begg was. I didn't even know who Alistair Begg was. I did a little research. Like, very famous preacher in Cleveland, like massive church. And she would tell me how great, and I was like, but yeah, that doesn't do much to me. Great, it's great. But if you were to come to me and be like, I just visited this small rural Mennonite church, and the preacher just blew me away, I might be like, well, that hurts a little more, right? Like, Alistair Begg, but a small Mennonite church, I might feel a little bit envious of that. My point is that we tend to be envious of things that are within reach, things that are up close, things that other people have that seem like we have the possibility of getting them. Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish theologian and philosopher, said that envy is a small-town sin. It's a byproduct of living so close to a set of other people that one is constantly tempted to make leveling comparisons. I've lived in a couple of small towns. Most of you probably have or grew up or live in a small town. I think that's really true. Envy is a small-town sin. It's not just a small-town sin. But there's something about the people that are right around you that you tend to compare yourself with the most, which is why I think we have a really unique challenge today. So think about it, like a long time ago, like if you lived in Columbiana, when you guys were growing up, actually, not to say that's a long time ago, some of you, like you only had so many amount of people to compare yourself to. If you're the butcher in Columbiana, you can compare yourself to two other butchers. Like you're not worried about some hipster butcher in Cleveland that is doing some amazing thing, right? Like that's not, you don't even know about them. The challenge with today because of the internet is all these people have been brought close to you. All these people that you got like a Christmas card from them last year and you were like, whatever. You now know what they ate for dinner last night. Like literally, you know what they ate for dinner last night, and it was a lot better than what you ate for dinner last night because you saw their picture. Rich is on a diet. I'm sorry. He knows what I'm. I'm sorry. I'm gonna repent. I've just been talking a lot to Rich about this new vegetable diet he's on. I'm sorry. Every time I go away from my notes, I get in trouble. Where was I? Okay. So let me give you an example. When I was growing up, nobody thought they could be famous. Like honestly, the fame you hoped for was that like you'd be at school and the local news people would be there and they'd film and you'd be like sitting in the back waving. And so you'd get home and you'd tell your mom and she would get out the VHS. Ask your parents what it is, and they would record the news, and you'd pause it, and there was you. Like, that's your fame. That's, like, pretty much what you hoped for. Like, if you're a kid now, like, you have people on YouTube that have millions of followers that look a lot like you do. They have a little bit different life to you, but that's a big shift in who you're comparing yourself to. Think about your summer vacations. It used to be, you know, your neighbors would tell you about what they went on. They'd pull out some pictures, and it was like, oh, great. Like, you didn't even really care about their summer vacations. Now, like, you care because everyone else has these amazing pictures that are coming at you right now of where they are, and, like, the summer vacation you just took all of a sudden doesn't look quite as great. My point is that everything is becoming closer to you. You have, like, it's a big, small town now with a lot to compare to. Teddy Roosevelt once famously said, comparison is the thief of joy. I think there's a lot of truth to that. And envy is so good at making us compare ourselves to people. We look at what we have, we look at that summer vacation or that whatever, that 5 seconds of fame. We look at what someone else has, we look back at what we have, and it looks a little bit lacking. Enough is out there, enough is over there, enough is what that other person has, enough is not what is right in front of me. And I think, to be honest, this is a pretty universal thing. So, like, some of you, like, will struggle with this, some of us will struggle with this more than others, But I would guess that all of us like know what envy feels like. I'd be shocked if you didn't know what envy felt like. And the ultimate example of this is in the passage we read this morning by Gloria from the book of Genesis in the Garden of Eden. So we read this story about Adam and Eve. Remember, we're not just reading a story. We're getting a glimpse of ourselves. We're seeing a part of ourselves in Adam and Eve. And think about it, like Adam and Eve are in paradise. Paradise. There's no death. There's no disease. There's meaningful work that they're doing. There's community with each other and with God. There's incredible food. There's all these fruit-bearing trees around them. It's perfect. Adam and Eve are in the nicest place in the world. It's a nicer place to live, believe it or not, than Columbiana. I say that because we're up for the nicest city in America. So just in case you don't know, sorry. If ever there should be a moment that there's no envy, it should be this. And among all this bounty, the serpent says to Adam and Eve, "Did God really say you must not eat from the tree in the garden?" And Eve responds, "No, we're allowed to eat from any tree, just not the one in the middle of the garden." And as Eve looks around the garden, suddenly a thought comes to her mind. I bet it's the best one. I bet that tree in the middle is the best. All these other options, but that's the best one. The fruit on there must be better than all the other ones combined, and it's within reach. And at that moment, when they reach for the fruit, they make a statement about what is basically behind all of our envy. And that is, God doesn't know what he's doing. If God really knew what he was doing, he would have given us this thing that we lack and we want. And what Adam and Eve succumb to is what we succumb to all the time. They reject the life that God has given them. They fail to see the good that is all around them. And instead focus on the one thing that was held back from them. And in doing so, they force themselves into exile, which is exactly what envy does. Instead of seeing all the bounty, all the goodness that God has given us, we become fixated, we become obsessed with that one thing that we don't have. And I'm telling you, if that is in the Garden of Eden, good luck not having that in our world. Don't be surprised when you feel that way. There's this great movie, Amadeus. It's older now. I'm going to reference two movies from the 80s. It's going to date me a little bit here, but it's about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And in her book, Glittering Devices, Rebecca DeYoung points out that it gives us this brilliant picture of envy and its destructive power. So the film's about a relationship between a court composer named Antonio Salieri and his famous rival, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And as a young man, Salieri has a fair amount of talent, and he promises his devotion and chastity if only God will make him a great composer. And he becomes quite famous for his time. But then Mozart comes on the scene. And Mozart is undeniably a brilliant composer, and he's far more than Salieri. And Salieri cannot believe that God would give such incredible talent to someone he thinks is an arrogant buffoon. And the scene opens with this great scene, this movie. Just watch, well, I can't remember all that happens in the movie, so it's got a great scene in the movie. But Salieri is an old man now, and he's visiting with a priest. And the priest doesn't really know who he is. The priest has come to get a confession of guilt from him because Salieri played some role in Mozart's death, so he has all this guilt. He tried to kill himself. So the priest is there to get a confession. And Salieri at first wants nothing to do with it, and finally he says, "Do you know who I am?" to the priest. And the priest doesn't really know who he is, but he tries to console him by saying, "All men are equal in God's eyes." And Salieri responds, "Are they?" He then proceeds to play several melodies for the priest, very popular in his day, that he had composed, expecting that the priest will recognize, and each time the priest says, "No, I don't recognize it." And finally, Salieri says, "One more." He said, well, I'm sorry, he says, do you not recall any melodies? I was the most famous composer in Europe. I wrote 40 operas alone. And he says, what about this one? And he plays one more. Dun, 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 dun. Forgive me, but. And the priest says, I know it. Oh, that's charming. I didn't know you wrote that. And Salieri's face darkens and he says, I didn't. That was Mozart. And de Young points out that the experience confirms what Salieri cannot admit about himself, but also cannot escape. His own musical talent will always be second rate and second best compared to Mozart's God-given gifts. And despite the priest's consolation that all men are created equal in God's eyes, in light of his rivalry with Mozart, he cannot believe this to be true. Jeff Cook, who wrote a book about the seven deadly sins, says, envy's three favorite words are, why not me? Why not me? Why that person? Why were they given this thing that I so desperately want? In 1 Corinthians 13:4, Paul writes, love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. I've never really noticed that. I mean, some of you probably have. Obviously, very famous verse about love. We hear it all the time, but I never caught envy. After resting in envy all week, it makes so much more sense to me. Remember when Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment? He said this, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and love your neighbor as yourself. So this is the command to love. Not just, actually three, commandment to love God, to love neighbor, and to love yourself. Because if you're going to love your neighbor, you have to love yourself. And envy, what's so damaging about envy is that it undercuts all three of these loves. It's destructive to all three of these kinds of love. Envy, first of all, makes it hard to love God. Because it's hard to love God when we are obsessed with what God has not given us. Envy makes it hard to love our neighbor. It's really hard to love someone and at the same time be envious of them. In fact, like some people will say, well, why isn't hate one of the seven deadly sins? If you envy someone long enough, if you let that fester, that will very often turn to hate. Because if we can't have what our neighbor has, at least we want them to lose it. And you can see this spiral here. We have the Garden of Eden story, but then quickly the children of Adam and Eve, Cain is envious of the status of Abel. What does he do? He murders him. We hear story after story. Joseph's brothers are envious of his favored status as a son, and they sell him off into slavery. It is very hard to love your neighbor and envy them at the same time. But not only does it undercut our love of neighbor and of God, and I think this is the one we often miss, and this is one I really want you to just kind of rest in. It undercuts our love of ourselves. It undercuts appreciation of the gifts that God has given us, of the person that God has made us. See, when our lives become consumed with envy, what we're basically saying to God is, the life you've given me and the person you've made me isn't good enough. That person over there with more talent or intelligence or beauty or success, that person might have been fearfully and wonderfully made. Not so sure about myself. And you see why this is so deadly and destructive? Because what this does is it moves us away from the God-given life and God-given talents and God-given person that we are. I mentioned to you at the beginning that this envy, we've got to see that envy is so much deeper than possessions. It's touching on probably the two things that are closest to us. We want to be loved and we want to be valued. And if you really pull back all the layers and you keep going and going and going, often what you'll find behind your envy is you want to be loved or you want to be valued. And what envy does is it says, if you could just have that, you'll be loved, and you'll be valued. I want to tell you for a minute why this is a lie. Whatever it is that you think that you're envious of that will solve this, it's highly likely to fall way short of your expectations. And here's the best way I can prove this to you. You might not be able to think now, but go home and think about this. At some point, you envied something that somebody else had. You wanted something really bad. And you thought, if I can get a hold of that, if that can come to me, things will change. I will be valued. I will be successful. I will be loved. So there's a job you wanted, and you got it. There was a number in your head for your retirement account, and you reached it. You always wanted to own a house. You own a house now. You always wanted a certain relationship with a boyfriend, a girlfriend, or spouse. You got that. You got something you envied for. I can almost guarantee you, you got something you wanted. You may not recognize it right now. And my question for you is, how is that working out? How's that working out? How long did that thing that was going to be the thing that solved everything, how long did that actually solve everything? Did your envy go away? Was all of a sudden, are we all just a bunch of people that have no envy? Or is it, do we turn to the next thing to fill that void? And if that's the case, why do we think that that next thing is going to be different than the last? And the last, and the last, and the last. That's my first point. Secondly, you need to realize that those people you are looking at and envying, they're not you. They're not living your life. They're not even on your path. And you are not on their path. Not only is it not your life, but you probably are failing to recognize that they have struggles that you don't. That they have obstacles in their path that are not yours. That their souls need repair just like yours, but in a different way. And that their gifts aren't your gifts. And what happens is when you obsess about that life that is not yours and trying to be that person that you are not are, you fail, like I said, to see the person that you are and the gifts that you were given and the path that is yours to walk. And God's response, when we push and push and push for Him to give us what is not ours, is what the Garden of Eden. It's exile. It's you do not know what you're asking. You want that fruit to be yours, but do you trust God enough to understand why it isn't yours? And here's the really hard part of envy, as I said. If you let it settle in, it will eat you up from the inside. It will actually destroy the things that make life joyful. Gratitude for what is in front of you. Love. Remember, envy is always going to push you away from people. Relationships. There are a million studies out now today about like how are you going to be happy. People are obsessed with happiness. Almost always it comes down to like relationships. Like that's just a massive part. And this thing is totally pushing against you being in relationship with other people. So I want you, as we move into this time of confession, repentance, and we turn to contentment, I want you to rest in that. Pull back these layers of yourself. Find out what is deep inside. And remember what I said last week, we can do this because we trust the one who's pulling it back. We trust that Jesus Christ, we can be vulnerable before Jesus Christ.
I rejoice greatly to the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I am not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content wherever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need. The secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want, I can do all things through Him who gives me strength.
So if envy is the poison, if envy is the ulcer, what is the antidote? And as I said, when we peel back these layers, I think what we're really hitting at are two things, this desire to be loved and this desire to feel valued. So let's start with that. When Jesus was baptized in the Jordan by John, very well-known scene, that the heavens tear open and there's a voice that comes down that says, "You are my son whom I love. With you I am well pleased." And somebody said something one time, I think it was on a podcast or something, that stuck with me. The guy said he thinks that Jesus is the only person that ever lived that when God said this to him, that he really believed it. I think that might be true. For the rest of us, we hear those words, we've heard them a million times, often we're not quite so sure. We're not quite so confident that we are loved. Because if the creator of the universe loves us in that way, everything else is kind of pales in comparison. But I don't think we usually feel that way. Because if you're anything like me, you seek validation from all kinds of other places. But what does it mean to rest in that? What does it mean to actually believe that you are the beloved? You're beloved like Jesus. Secondly, and Paul says it so clearly in this verse in Philippians, we need to learn to be content in various circumstances. So Paul doesn't write to the Philippians from prison. Remember, this letter is from prison, and say, "I've learned the secret of contentment, and it is indeed making $10 more an hour than your brother-in-law." It's not what Paul's journey took him. No, he says that whether well-fed or hungry, in plenty or in want, the secret of contentment is a relationship with Jesus Christ, the one who has given strength to Paul in all the hardships that he had experienced at that point. Remember in Adam and Eve, they had everything, and yet there was one thing that they didn't have, and they wanted more. Might much of our task be here recognizing the gifts that God has already given us? Like recognizing the goodness that is already in our life and giving thanks for that. And here's why I think this is so important, to be content. It doesn't mean that we don't strive for excellence. Here's the difference, is we strive for excellence, but we do it out of a place of joy and freedom. That's the game changer right there. You don't stop seeking things, but you do it from a very different place. You're freed from envy, and so you can find contentment in this life. And the point is that if we are to follow after Jesus, if we are to do it from a place of freedom and joy, we are then free to exercise the gifts that God has given us because we're secure in our self-worth. We're going to better use our gifts that God has given us if we are secure than if we are envious. And second movie I want to tell you about, one of my favorite all times, I can unequivocally say go home and watch this movie because it's great, Chariots of Fire. Anybody else? Chariots? Okay. That's what my wife says when I suggest it on family movie night. So great movie about these two British runners preparing for and competing in the 1924 Summer Olympics. And like the film Amadeus, there's two rivals. One is Eric Liddell. The other is Harold Abrams. And they're both rivals in this quest for gold in the 100-yard dash. And each of them is extremely gifted athlete. Each of them is very competitive. Each of them is driven to excellence in running. But as the movie develops, you see that these two people are actually driven by two very different things. Abrams is devoted to winning, but it's because he's afraid to lose. And the first time he runs a race and loses, his whole self-image is dashed to pieces. And he turns to his girlfriend and he says, "If I can't win, I won't run." And Abrams' identity, Rebecca DeYoung notes, is that of an envier. Abrams gives us a good picture of an envier. He's defensive. He's afraid of being shown inferior, and he's only happy when he outranks his opponents. So in other words, in order to be worth something, Abrams has to be better than somebody else. And that's typically how enviers see the world. If they're going to feel good, they've got to be better than somebody else. Abram's love for himself is totally contingent on his performance. And that is what drives Abram's in this quest for Olympic gold. Eric Liddell, on the other hand, is driven by something else. And he explains it in this great scene with his sister. His sister wants him to return to China as a missionary, and she's not even sure that the Liddell should even be competing in these Olympics. And Liddell says to his sister, Jenna, I believe God made me for a purpose, to be a missionary in China. But he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. And to win is to honor him. See, Liddell is driven to compete, to run, to strive for excellence with the gifts that God has given him, but not so that he can win God's favor, but so that Liddell can revel in God's favor. And as he takes that last lap around the track, his head goes back, and it's a scene of just utter reveling in the favor of God. He loves to compete, not because he needs to win, but because he loves to run well. And Liddell is free to do that because he has this calm confidence of knowing he is someone worth something, whatever place he finishes. And so when he runs, when he exercises those God-given gifts, it's not out of a place of fear, but freedom and joy. And as we move into a place of security in our love and our identity as God's children, when we look at the cross and realize we are of infinite worth, we move closer to that place, and we are set free to run the race, not driven by fear, but gladness, contentment, freedom, and joy.